Hello and welcome to the Inheritance Podcast. I'm Joe Riley. Today we are talking to Paul Sullivan, founder of the Company of Dads and the former Wealth Matters columnist for the New York Times. Paul is the best-selling author of two books, Clutch, Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Some Don't, and The Thin Green Line, The Money Secrets of the Super Wealthy. We talk about his decade of studying the wealthy for the Times, fatherhood, teaching children about wealth, and the community of lead dads he is building nationwide. I'm interested in how you developed your attitudes towards two things, one, wealth and money, and the other on parenting.
So I'll take them in that order, Joe. On wealth, my parents were divorced when I was 10, and my dad's a great grandfather now, but I say they were not very good at being married, and turns out they were even worse at being divorced. And it was tough because my father had inherited three businesses in our area, a home building business, a paving business, and a trucking business. These are not gigantic family enterprises that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, but these were family businesses that had allowed my paternal grandfather to retire to Florida in his 50s when nobody retired to Florida in their 50s. And it didn't go well. Over the course of several years, all of these businesses dissolved and it caused incredible strife among my mom and dad.
This is in the 1970s?
1970s. I was born in 1973. So this is around about 75, 76. And they built a lot of homes in Wilbraham for those of us, any other listeners who are from Western Massachusetts, like Joe and me, and they had three designs. We picked, it was like a proto Toll Brothers. You had three designs that you could pick from. That was it. And that really caused a lot of strain on my parents' marriage and obviously led to them getting divorced eventually. But in the beginning, my attitude toward money was a horrible attitude. It was like, I don't want any money. I don't want to be around money. This is horrible. Because I associated money with something more than it is. Money is a means of exchange. I talk about this in my second book, The Thin Green Line. And or you could look at money as gasoline. If you have more money, you can go farther like you can with a full tank of gas. But if you're not careful and you don't think through the choice around money, you can literally set yourself on fire, as you can also do with gasoline. And I just was always fascinated by not so much the lifestyles of the rich and famous approach to money, but how people gain their wealth and how they thought through generational transfers, how they thought through education around it. And when I was at the Financial Times, where I worked from 2000 to 2006, the US editor said, we need to start a wealth column. And this was shortly after Robert Frank had started his column at the Wall Street Journal. And I put my hand up to do it. And I know Robert a little bit. I think he's a wonderful human being, wonderful journalist. But when you read Richestan and all the stuff he does, Robert, and this is very reductive, Robert took an approach more of, oh my God, it's a $300 million yacht. And can you believe the $300 million yacht? And I, starting with column at almost exactly the same time, I took the different approach. Like, huh, if you have a $300 million yacht, how much does it cost to insure it every year? How much does the crew cost? If you take it out for 2 hours, how much does that cost in fuel? Let's not even think about the Pinot Grigio and the crab claws and the people who live on it. Do you even know how to drive your yacht? Would you ever charter the yacht? And so I took much more of a nuts and bolts approach to it because what fascinated me all along was how people retained wealth. And that's it's obvious. You can look, as I told you about my background, why I would think that way, why that influenced me. But the other thing I thought about wealth, and this will segue into parenting, as I thought about choices, even the wealthiest people in the world have to make choices around their money. And this is the premise of the Thin Green Line, that if you're making good choices, you're going to be on the right side of that line. You're going to be wealthy, whether you're a high school teacher or you're part of the Huntsman family or something like that. You have to make good choices. And if you make lousy choices, then you're either poor or you're rich. And you could be a super leveraged financier who's months away from dissolution. And so it was always the choices. And so parenting to me was about the choices that we could make around our time. And that was really essential. I've been married for 15 years. I've been with my wife for 18. And I didn't meet her until I was in my 30s. And 20s were wonderful. And I had a lot of fun. And I did all stuff I wanted to do. I traveled. I went out a lot, played golf, did all these fun things. But I continued to have fun when I was married. But when I had kids, I thought, okay, what part of me can I still retain from the single years? And how am I going to change? And what I found out is that you can still do a lot of the same things that you want to do. You can just do them less frequently. You can't do them all the time. You can't do them as long. And I tell the story of when the first time my first daughter was maybe 3 months old, my wife and I went out with some friends who didn't have kids and we hadn't been out yet. And I was like, this is awesome. Woohoo. And I had, I don't know, four glasses of wine or something like that. And I felt so awful when my daughter woke me up at 5 a.m. the next morning. I was like, I don't think I'm going to do that again. And so I become a two glass of wine drinker ever since. But it was all about choices. And so my parenting philosophy became about how do I make choices in life around this? And for me, being a columnist for the New York Times, it was amazing. It was a dream job, but I never wanted to be an editor. I never wanted to be something else. And the reason was I knew from Bloomberg, the Financial Times, Institutional Investor, all these other places I had worked, that you could either have freedom or you could have power as a journalist. And I wanted to have freedom. I wanted to be able to own my own time. And I wanted to pursue something that I found deeply fascinating. Like I wrote 608 columns and maybe there was a week or two in there that I couldn't come up with an idea or I was a little stumped. I'm not saying all of them were brilliant, but I just was passionate about what I was doing. So it was fun. And I was able to carve out time and apply that same passion and those, that same sort of choice architecture around being a parent to now three daughters.
So let's go back. St. Patrick's Day, 2008, Bear Stearns has just collapsed. You're interviewing at the New York Times. How did you get your dream job?
Through poker.
Tell us.
I'm a lousy poker player, but I was in this group playing poker and I was at the Financial Times and then I was at Condé Nast Portfolio, which is was an amazing run, but you couldn't have had a worse time to start a glossy business magazine, which started in 2007. And burned through $100 million by 2009. If you plotted to do it, and these were, this is the Newhouse family, wildly sophisticated, just horrible timing.
And can I stop you? Because I forgot about that part of your career, but you have to tell us, what was that trip like?
It was a rocket ship. I'll tell you one story. Like I wrote one of the early pieces on the business of Tiger Woods, and this is old school. This is the end of Condé Nast, as people knew it, the legendary Condé Nast. And I was following him around and North Carolina, LA, Cabo San Lucas, everybody following him around. And I would get in the helicopter, I would get in the airplane. Kanye, you had to do everything. And I remember being out in LA and Tiger was staying at the Hotel Bel Air. And they said, you need to stay at the Hotel Bel Air. And this is 15 years ago. I don't know. Let's say it was $700 a night. It was something like mind-blowingly at the time, like the equivalent of $2,000 a night now. And they said, you must stay there. And I was on the trip following around with this guy, Alan Bastable, who is a longtime editor at Golf Magazine. And he was staying at the Motel 6 for $4 a night. And he said, where are you staying? I was like, Hotel Bel Air, man. This is what Condé Nast tells you have to do. And I stayed there. And I called my college roommate, the best man at my wedding, Josh. And I said, Josh, you got to come over here. He's like, why? He's like, you got to stay with me. I'm going to be gone all day, but somebody has to sit by the pool and have this full experience. And it was incredible, but it was absolutely the end of an era in journalism.
You think that's a good way to manage a magazine?
I thought it was a fantastic way to manage a magazine. I think more generationally wealthy people who have magazine empires should go back to spending their money that way.
Back to New York Times, you got your dream job. Tell us about the learning curve for you on that job, because there was a lot of learning on the fly. You obviously had a background at the FT and understood a lot of this world, but what was the learning curve like figuring out the wealthy?
I had already been writing the column for the Financial Times. I wrote it for a couple years before I left the FT and worked on my first book and then went to Condé Nast Portfolio. So I understood the wealth beat and they knew that I was a known entity and they knew how I would approach this. And my goal was always, if I could take the sort of actions and practices and beliefs of the wealthy and find a way to make it applicable, not all the time, but more or less applicable to the upper middle class and middle class readers of the New York Times, then I was doing my job. The middle and upper middle class readers of the New York Times are not going to have a $300 million yacht, to go back to that analogy, but maybe they do have a $100,000 Sea Ray or something like that. And how do you think through the purchases that you make and the choices? So that part of it was an easy enough transition. The more difficult part is the New York Times is an institution. It's a wonderful institution, but you have to do things certain ways. And I think the FT being a British newspaper and also at the time a British newspaper making inroads into the US, it was a lot more freewheeling the way you could approach things. And so I had a wonderful editor named Phyllis Messenger, and she took me aside. I remember writing the first column and I'm like dancing in there and I'm like, oh yeah. And she said, let's sit down and talk. I was like, okay. And it was a classic, here's a red pen. And I learned a lot. And this sort of can apply back to parenting, to life in general. And one of my sort of mantras is don't make the same mistake twice. And so I looked at it as, okay, I'm going to study what she has done to this first column and do my best to understand it and keep going. What I was most proud of is they were a little leery in the beginning because they had the Your Money column that Ron Lieber writes and they'd never had a wealth column before. And this is, you don't do this anymore. Like, it ran some of the time in the paper and some of the time online only. And that was the setup. And then I gradually worked on it and became in the paper all the time. And then they started selling ads against it. And once they started selling ads against the Wealth Matters column, which almost always ran on page 5 of the business section, then I knew I had job security. And then I knew, okay, this is good because this column is contributing economically to the business section. And we kind of went from there. But just again, I don't want to sound like a big toady. It's just wonderful. There's some parts where some weeks were tough, but it just was just a wonderful group of people to work with and to be able to write about the wealth and to have the reach that I had on a topic like this in a paper like the New York Times was incredible. I never took it for granted. I always knew it came with great responsibility.
I'm sure you had a lot of reach based on the institution, but what was it like trying to negotiate access and to get closer to your subjects?
It wasn't very difficult because I had a body of work. I had a body of work and I could just say, look, chances are it's going to be more or less like this, but I'm not a gotcha guy, what I'm trying to do. But also because I'm a crazy planner and my calendar looks like a Tetris game with all different blocks in it, I would plan out weeks and weeks in advance if I wanted to talk. And I think I had another advantage, even though I grew up lower middle class in Western Massachusetts, me and my wife has done well. We live in New Canaan, Connecticut. And so I was living in a world where I didn't look at the wealthy as if they were a shiny object or like a white tiger in the zoo. I really went in to understand how they were living their lives and the good and the bad. I took lessons from them. I took around the good and the bad of the way they thought about wealth and children and inheritance and education. I don't think I'm ever going to have $1 billion, but let's say the company does this pretty well and I have a little bit more wealth. I've already learned those lessons that they applied, both the good and the bad. You learn from people who've screwed it up and you learn from people who've done it the right way. So I think they knew that I was genuinely interested and I'd sit down and I'd talk to them. And also, I think I ignored a lot of nonsense. And I remember one guy years ago saying, oh yeah, you work for the liberal New York Times and you hate the wealthy. And I'm like, sir, I'm just going to ask you the following questions. And you know what? Just so you know, my policy is I'm going to ask you the questions. And if you don't want to answer them, don't answer them. You don't have to. You're not obligated to answer my questions, but let's just move forward. And because I took the nonsense out of it, we ended up having a perfectly fine interview. And by the end, he was, I'm not going to say he was won over, but he respected the process and ended on a much better note than we began.
The other interesting thing about your columns was that you took the wealth management and asset management space seriously, and that's a whole other world unto itself outside of their clients. And I'm wondering how you found your way among them and found your way to understanding the advisors.
I guess that's, if anything, that was a little easier because when you're talking to the principal, and I remember talking to John Huntsman Sr. once, and the great industrialist, inventor of the clamshell shell pack that a Big Mac is in, packing peanuts, every plastic thing you could ever think of. And he and I just had a rapport. And I thought, I'm not going to get that much time with a billionaire. He'll be off with me in 10 minutes. We ended up talking for an hour and we ended up, I was on his Christmas card list. It's just a very large family. He's got 8 kids there. Something like that. You have a very large Mormon family. And this giant Christmas card arrived. And I just had a wonderful rapport with him. Talking to people in the wealth management space, I think it was easier because they wanted to tell their story because there's competition. But again, I don't want to sound arrogant. I was really knowledgeable about what they did and how they did it. And so if they tried to feed me a line of crap, I would call BS on it. And I would, you could think early on, early days, like 2010, 2011, like, we only work with clients who have more than $25 million. And I'm like, that's not true. There aren't that many people. You have this giant business and there just aren't that many people in the country that have more than that amount of money. You wouldn't have a viable business. But we don't have all their $25 million. We have 3 of their $25 million. It's like, okay, that's fair. Be honest. And so I would push back, but take my work seriously, but I don't take myself seriously. So I think I had a good manner about it so that in pushing back, I wasn't calling them a fabulist or something like that. I was saying, let's just be honest here and let's get into the details. And I think what I love the most is I love getting into the weeds and understanding how things really worked. And I think they respected that.
How do you think that industry has changed over the course of your career?
The consolidation. I think it's changed. We see it again and again in every industry. They get bigger until they don't, and then they start to splinter. And I think the most challenging thing is early on, particularly when I was at the FT, you could be selling some sort of investment solution earnestly and say, here's this investment solution and it's going to work for you and blah, blah, blah. But with the move toward open architecture, to say it in a positive way or in a more negative way, that these products have become commodities. Presenting somebody with a whiz-bang XYZ product isn't really going to get you that far. And it's what's changed is the real reliance on what used to be called the softer stuff. Because if you've got these giant firms and then you have these small boutiques, what really differentiates you? And it's the advice that you can give as you can help people, guide people to make the best choices that they can. And those choices may be around how they invest their money. It may be around how they structure their estate plan, or it may be around how they think about giving to their alma mater, how they think about giving to their house of worship, how they think about having conversation with their kids. And, you know, there are a couple firms that I don't want to do an advertisement for anyone, but there are a couple firms early on that got into these next generation seminars. Now, every firm has a next generation seminar, but those are really important because when you're helping people's kids, you're helping the whole family and people remember when you help their kids. So they were savvy. Everyone's always trying to think of the new hook, but I think the big differentiator is the advice, the stuff that really helps people. And that's hard to commoditize because you need somebody with deep knowledge and who's built a trust relationship with people to allow that to happen.
How did you decide what to write about each week? Are there any tropes of wealth that you tried to avoid?
I try to avoid the can you believe it type stories. But when I wrote my 500th column of 608, when I wrote the 500th column, I went back and I'm not going to say I read 499 columns. That would be a little too solipsistic. But I went back and I skimmed them. And it was interesting that they broke down into certain buckets. All the ones that were news driven happened early that week and were crafted. Those are usually around some sort of policy issue, usually around taxes or usually around estate planning. But then there was another group that was around decision making, another group that was around discussions, often around either.
You mean decision making?
I'm going to do X over Y. Or how do you, that was a smaller group, but they were like the more complicated stuff. When trying to, news you could use, and this is when they didn't really apply to the middle class and the upper middle class, like explaining certain structured products or explaining things that were esoteric and to try to break it down into English. And then the discussion part around kids and philanthropy. And then there was a part that was just fun. And they were fun in the way that I didn't poke fun at anybody, but they were like good reads. And I remember the first time I was on A1 of the New York Times, a big deal. If you're in my office, you'd see one of the printing plates here. It was for this short-lived company that was essentially the world's highest end pawn shop. And they had an office on Lexington in the high 50s. You could literally pawn your Bentley. You could go in there and they had people pawning their Bentley. And that was had no greater purpose to serve other than this is fascinating and whoever came up with this idea. And so there was a group of those that were always light, interesting reads.
You described a certain percentage of your columns as voyeuristic, owning sports teams, owning planes, building large boats. Did you develop any opinions on what is excessive and what is just par for the course? How do people normalize these things in their lives?
Excessive is a value judgment. And I thought that wasn't something I wanted to do because look, no matter how much money you have or how much wealth you have or what you earn, there's always going to be something in your life that is excessive compared to your level of wealth. What I did take away is my oldest daughter rides horses and she rides at a, I always caveat this by saying she rides at a nonprofit barn in New Canaan where they get a lot of donated horses. And I don't know, probably 10 horses have died in the 7 years she's been doing it. These are old horses. But one of the things I did learn is like, I will never ever buy a horse. And that was the one thing where I did have a value judgment on is I could buy any number of things. I could buy a boat. A few times I've been able to fly private. I would dream of one day being able to fly private. I assess no value judgment to that, but I would never, ever buy a horse. And I remember talking to a guy who owned part of American Pharoah at one point. And he'd been very successful. He'd done other things in finance, but been very successful with owning horses and really breeding horses, which is where the money's made. But it felt to me, whenever I talked to the horse people, it felt to me like going to that cocktail party in 1992 and somebody says, I got a stock tip for you. I got Apple. Apple's going to be big. Get Apple. And yeah, Apple turned out to be big, but the guy may have had a whole bunch of other stock tips. Like, here, this company's going to be founded called pets.com. You should get into it as soon. And people always, when you're talking about something like that, which is a super passion project, they only tell you about their winners and they don't tell you about their losers.
Here's a quote from your book, The Thin Green Line. Despite enormous bank accounts, each one, and you're talking about Tiger 21 members, each one had concerns that no amount of money could fix. While I had learned something from each of them, I wasn't sure I would trade places with any of them. How did you come to that conclusion?
Tiger 21 has become a much larger, most nationally diverse group than it was when I talked to them. That was probably, I don't know, 8-9 years ago. But they were an edgy group of guys, or at least the group that I was in. I'm sure a lot of your listeners know Tiger 21. It's usually a group of 12 people. They have a facilitator. They do these portfolio defenses. And they were a super edgy group. And at one point they went around the room, and I talk about it in that piece, they went around the room and tried to out-humble each other. They tried to say who had the humblest of humble beginnings. And I'm like, this is fascinating, because they weren't trying to say, I've got more money than you. It's like, no, I started even lower down and look what I did. And in another book, talked about one of the things that drives entrepreneurs, and the trade-off is a gross simplification, but the trade-off between fear and desire, like the desire to be wildly successful, the desire to see your idea come to fruition, the fear of abject failure and what you're going to do. And these guys, even though they were so successful, I mean, you need at least probably more now, but back then you needed $10 million to be a member of Tiger. You need to pay whatever, 30 grand a year, probably more than that today. And yet they still had that fast twitch. And I learned a lot from a conversation I had before he passed away with John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard. And he wrote a book called Enough. And enough wasn't a dollar amount. It wasn't like, okay, when you get to X, stop. It was real creative accord for people to think deeply about what their wealth and what their money was going to do for them. And by all accounts, John Bogle was a very happy guy, but he and Ned Johnson of Fidelity started off at the same time on very different paths, and their level of wealth was hugely different. Ned Johnson is a billionaire many times over. I don't think John Bogle was. And so he really was somebody who thought deeply. And I think this kind of comes back to my thinking on wealth, my thinking on parenting. Oftentimes, if we could just step back and think a little bit more about why we want something or why we're doing something, I mean, we may still do it in the end. I'm not judging anybody, but like having that thought process and making it more intentional can lead to better outcomes. And I think somebody like John Bogle was really great at doing that.
I do want to give you a chance to define your difference between being wealthy and being rich.
It's all about choices. And so the concept of the Thin Green Line is the S&P 500 from 1982 to now. It's much higher today, even after this year, than it was in 1982, but it's not a short line. It's a jagged line. And people who are on the top of that line, that green line, that thin green line, are wealthy. Again, whether they have a more modest income or they're billionaires, they've orchestrated their life so that they can have choices. People on the other side of that line, if you don't have a lot of money, that's not a disparaging comment. You just have to earn more. You don't have choices by dint of the fact that you're not a high earner. But there are plenty of people on the wrong side of the thin green line who are just rich. And for them, choices could one day be made for them, as opposed to them always having the ability to make choices. And that's really the difference between being wealthy and rich. And that's one of the things that I work into how I think about parenting. Let's think of the choices that we can make, whether we're where our economic circumstances are. There are always choices you can make around your parenting.
What do you think about the traditional clash between new money and old money? And is that even a relevant conversation?
I don't know if it's as relevant now as it used to be. Our mutual friend, Jim Grubman, talks about natives and immigrants to wealth. I don't think anybody's going to say it better than he did. That is just a fascinating way to frame it. But I mean, I remember I lived in Boston for a couple of years, and I lived on Beacon Hill, and we were the renters. We lived in Lewisburg Square, so the fanciest neighborhood in Beacon Hill, diagonally across from John Kerry. And we were the renters. And I thought, yeah, of course we're the renters. This place is awesome. I don't have to look at my crappy brownstone. I can look at your beautiful brownstone. This is that. And like Boston felt at the time, this is 2006 to 2008, still felt like a very class-driven city in a way that a city like Philadelphia, I love Philadelphia, can feel that way. But I just think I don't know if that's really realistic now. There's so much wealth, and Jim Grubman has written a lot about this, and just America is a country of entrepreneurs, and the vast majority earn their wealth in a generation. And so I don't know if that, I'm sure for some people that still holds true, but I don't think the old class structures matter. I don't think it matters that your was an X or you come from Y family that has been wealthy for 150 years. It matters in some ways that you have access to stuff, but I think look at the wealthiest people in the world right now. None of them are old money unless you count the Walton family of Walmart. They're probably the oldest of old money on that list.
All your 608 columns, did you find anyone who did money the right way?
That's a great question. I don't know if I did. That's not true. I would think most of the people did money the right way. I don't know if I did. What is money the right way? I wrote a whole book on this, The Thin Green Line, which is how I think that people should do money the right way. And I've more or less lived my life along the architecture of that book. The idea beyond the line and being wealthy or rich, but the secondary idea is there are only four things you can do with money. You can spend it, save it, give it away, or think about it or obsess about it. I'm not going to name him, and I try to not describe him too well so people can't find him. But there was a guy who I was super impressed with how he thought about money and how he thought about money and his children and how he thought about the value of things. So you have a $100,000 Range Rover. It doesn't really cost $100,000. It costs $200,000 because you're buying it in pre-tax money unless you're putting it through your company or something like that. And he did all these like little things so well. And I held him up as a model for a long time. And I still think his thinking around money is fantastic. But then he was indicted for fraud at a bank that he ran. So I was like, I didn't really follow the case. I'm not really sure if he was guilty of all the things that he was indicted for. But that one really bummed me out because I thought that guy had it down pat and then he was indicted.
Did a lot of work with Brad Klontz when you wrote the book. What did you learn about teaching children good habits around wealth?
Brad is a really deep thinker and he talks a lot about money scripts and the things that inform our deep seated beliefs. And so his whole thing is children often get screwed up around money by the parents because of an inability for the parents to explain what's happening. So I'll give you an example that he gives a lot. Parent, mom, dad, two kids, they're about to lose their house. Okay. They're made some bad decisions about it. Three scenarios happen. One, grandparents come in, bail them out. They don't lose the house. Two, they find a way to scrape and save and somehow save the house themselves. And three, they lose the house. Now, the precipitating event is all the same. They're about to lose the house. And there are three very different outcomes. And those three very different outcomes are what inform kids around how the scripts that get printed and they take forward. And one of the things that Brad and I, and he's in my book, I've done some research with Brad. I'm on a couple of his research papers. And one of the things that we find is that people don't talk to their children about money. And by honestly, you don't need to say to your kids, I make X million dollars a year. But you do need to have these honest conversations because they're going to go on Zillow and know how much your house costs. They're going to figure out how much the Mercedes, the BMW, the whatever you drive costs. They're going to realize how much their private school costs. They're going to realize that you take X amount of trips a year, and however you get to those trips, they're going to figure that out. And so what they're going to have is data, but they're not going to have context. And so where parents do the most good is they provide that context and they don't try to pretend that they have less money than they do. They tackle it head on and they talk about the values associated with that.
Are there ways to help people make better choices?
It all starts with having those conversations. It all starts with sitting down. And you can take that paper example that I gave for couples and apply it to just about anything. And one of the things I used to do, similar to paper, I'm old school, but I would tell people, write down all your expenses and write down the things that you want to do and the things that are meaningful to you. And I never judged. I'm not actually not a judgy guy. So I never judged and said, hey, you can do this, but you can't do that. I said, okay, if these things are important to you, if it is important for you to spend $5 on a Starbucks every day, if it's important to you to drive a Mercedes 550, whatever, if these things bring you joy, by all means, if you have the money, do it. But then know that there are other choices that you're going to have to make if you still want to fulfill those long-term financial goals. Substitute in fatherhood and children and parenting. There are choices you're going to have to make if you still want to fulfill your long-term parenting goals and your child-rearing goals.
Your new endeavor since you left the New York Times is called The Company of Dads, which discusses lead dads who are fathers who take on the chief childcare role. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got started?
I was a journalist for 25 years. You and I have talked about this a lot. I grew up outside of Springfield, Massachusetts in Ludlow, which is exit 7 off the Mass Pike, which most people drive past between Boston and going to the Berkshires. And growing up as a kid, I wanted to be a New York Times reporter. We didn't get the Times. I didn't really know anybody got the Times. I remember reading the Times at the library and it worked out. Fast forward to age 35 and I got to create the Wealth Matters column in the New York Times and I loved every minute of it. I wrote a weekly column. I helped run some of the special sections around money and giving and retirement. I wrote two books in the process. I gave a bunch of keynote talks. I moderated panels. Everything was great about it. But one thing that people didn't know is that starting when I was 36, slightly more than a year into being the Wealth Matters columnist for the New York Times, I became a dad. And more than that, I became a super involved dad. It worked out well because my wife works in asset management and she didn't have a lot of control over her schedule. And I had almost total control over mine. And fast forward to 2013, and she went to her then partner and said, hey, it's time. I'm going to start my own firm. Why don't we just split up amicably, put the clients first. You keep your clients. I'll take my clients that I came in with. And in 2-3 months, I'll start it. And he said, sure, it's great. And of course, where the story's going is like the next day or the day after, he completely shut her off from the system and essentially fired her. So no bonus, nothing. And she turns to me and says, oh my God, I thought this was going to be a 3-month runway. It was all going to be amicable. And I said, oh, I guess not. And she said, what am I going to do? And I said, you'll start the firm. And she says, what about the kids? And at the time we had 2 daughters, we have 3 now. And she says, what about the kids? And I said, I'll be the lead dad. And she said, what's that? And I said, I don't know, but it sounds better than I'll panic or we'll get like the dogs, the Labradors to watch them. And I joked with her, saying, look, my first book was Clutch, Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Others Don't. I can figure this out. But what it really meant was, as the lead dad, I became the go-to parent. And I was able to do that because my schedule at the times was totally rigid. Every Wednesday between 5 and 5:30, I filed my column. It would be edited by Thursday afternoon and get a final read by Friday. And I could plan everything around that. And so I was early into sort of working from home. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I would work from home. Everybody who knew me, who I worked with, who I met with over the years knew that Thursday was always my day in New York City. And Friday, I'd sometimes be there as well. And it worked great. Fast forward to the pandemic and we're all inside. We're all sitting inside as everybody else was. And our kids are doing remote learning. I'm as busy as I can possibly be. As a joke, this is all the polls show that people don't like journalists because it's a crisis. It's a global pandemic. And I'm like, this is so exciting. The gang is all back together. We're writing stories that matter. This is amazing. And my wife is busy, but in a different way. She's, holy cow, I've built this business over the past 7 years. What is going to happen to the asset management industry in a global pandemic? And of course, nobody thinks that what actually happened, that it went straight up, was going to happen. You would have been a crazy person if you predicted that. And it was in that moment that I thought, boy, I don't have my golf buddies. I don't have my friends around town. I don't have all my colleagues at the Times. I don't have the people I would see when I go into the city because it's stay at home. We're staying at home. I was like, I'm not a lonely guy, but I'm kind of lonely. And I thought, I wonder, there's got to be some sort of community for dads like me. So I go to the Google and the Google tells me that there is no community. And I said, how is this possible? And I think to myself, every other type of parent has a group. If you're that go to work dad, you get on the train in New Canaan, where I live, get on the train in Greenwich, where you live, you go into the city, you got tons of community. If you're a stay at home mom, these towns are made for you. You have your school, your house of worship, any hobbies or sports that you play, you have community. Every school district in America, even the crummiest company in America, has groups for working moms. But if you're the lead dad, whether you work full-time, part-time, or devote all your time to your children, you don't have a group. You're the butt of jokes. You're Mr. Mom, your house husband, you're quote-unquote retired. And so I thought, huh, that's interesting. So I did it as a journalist. I did a lot of research. There are about 3 different groups. We can talk about this a bit more. 3 different groups that lead dads fall into, but we estimate there's somewhere between 20 and 25 million lead dads in the United States out of 75 million fathers and 125 million men. And so with that idea, I started to say, okay, I've got the data. Is it real? And I knew as a guy, in particular as a guy who'd never led with Paul Sullivan lead dad, I'd always led with Paul Sullivan, New York Times columnist, I knew that men wouldn't be honest with me. They wouldn't tell me the truth. And so I started polling senior female executives who had families and were still married. And I asked them how they did it. And of course, this isn't totally scientific. These are the people I happen to know. But to a T, they all said that they had a lead dad in their life, either somebody who devoted all of his time to the family or somebody who had a rigid schedule or a flexible schedule and was able to do that. And then that brings us to last year, 2021. I went to the deputy business editor, told him what I was going to do. He was incredibly supportive. Let me wind down my Wealth Matters column as I in due course. And at the very end, they asked me to write a final column. Essentially, what was it like to write 608 Wealth Matters columns for the New York Times? What was it like to have over 1 million words in the New York Times over 13 years? And then add a bonus, tell the readers what you're going to do next. And that was the most incredible thing because then I got to tell the readership of the New York Times that I was leaving to start the company Dads. And then February 2022, we started and we've been off to the races ever since.
You talk to us a bit about what fatherhood means today versus when you grew up.
It means being a lot more involved, and it'd be hard to be a father today and be distant. There's certainly some who do it, but I think there's a huge, we've gone beyond like the shame component, and there is a desire to pitch in. And one of the things that we found at the company of dads is that there was this reset that came out of COVID where men who had been going off to work and women too, they suddenly were at home working and they realized, we can really shift some of the burden here. We can do work in a different way. But more than that, they also realized, I like this. I don't want to go back to the office 5 days a week. I don't want to stay home 5 days a week, but I want to have a more intentional schedule so that I don't just see my kids early in the morning and maybe late at night. And the best companies realize this, but a lot of companies don't. And it's really being driven by the people in their 20s and 30s, those people who are coming up right now. Maybe they're in the middle, maybe they're a little past the middle, and they're going to change the way that working moms or working dads operate going forward because they're just that desire to be involved. Like, I can't imagine, again, I want to slam my dad, who's a great grandfather, but I don't know if he changed a diaper in his life until my daughters came along. And that was okay. It just wouldn't be okay today. Just sometimes social works. And I think the social pressure has worked here for men to be more involved, but also for millennials to think differently and say, you know what? My career is X, but my wife's career is Y. And maybe she has the career that is more time consuming, more dominant. Maybe she's going to be the higher earner. How do we figure this out so we can both be fulfilled? And that's not a conversation that was happening 20, 25 years ago.
So how do you figure that out?
You talk, man. One of the things I tell people, I do this seminar in which I get husbands and wives to get a piece of paper. I believe in simple. I get a piece of paper and I say, okay, write down everything that you do and everything you think your spouse does. And then they write it down and then they compare and we talk it through. And 100% guarantee is that each person has a longer list of the things that they do and a shorter list of the things that they think their spouse does. And the other thing is 100% guarantee. When you go and you trade, you're going to look at that and say, huh, I didn't know you did that, or boy, you didn't do that. Because what happens when there's friction in a relationship is you don't add those 25 time-consuming tasks on day one of becoming a parent. It's like dust gathering under your dresser. If you don't check it, you finally check it. Oh my God, that's horrifying. There's so much dust under there. It's an accretion. And that's what all of these tasks are. It's an accretion of these tasks that lead to resentment. And I think couples, particularly as they've gone on together, they need to do this paper drill and have a reset and think, okay, what is this really fair? Are there certain things that I could do? And then allow the other person to own that task. You don't want to be saying, hey, don't forget to do this, or hey, did you do that today? The person owns the task and you go for it. But it all starts with that conversation of seeing what is each person really doing.
What are the major challenges that lead dads face?
For the role to be considered normal. And for them to be able to talk about it. And it's one of the things that we've got a weekly podcast, we've got a weekly newsletter, we have these features called the Lead Dad of the Week. And that, I can't, this is again self-serving, but I can't tell you how many guys who come to me and say, thanks for doing this. I feel like I have a community where I can talk about it. And these are men who are working. These are men who have careers, but they've taken on this role as the go-to parent because, again, they have more flexibility or they have a more rigid career, but they didn't feel like they could talk about this with your typical go-to-work dad who has a different arrangement with his spouse. And it's that feeling of, okay, I belong somewhere. And again, this is not a small number of people. The total available market is somewhere around 20, 25 million people. But how do we make it normal for them to be that go-to parent? And how do we shift the dynamic in society so that the schools, the doctor's offices, the playdate coordinators are actually calling the lead dad and not the working mom?
What kind of role does the lead dad have in the child's life?
Role model. I've got three daughters and a different type of role model. Parents are always role models, whether they want to be or not, whether they're setting out to be. Our kids, we can talk all we want. Our kids don't listen to us. They watch us. And so I think about this on a personal note. I have three daughters and they see the dynamic that my wife and I have and how we share a lot of things and certain things she takes a lead on, certain things I take a lead on. And we have arguments. We have arguments. This isn't smooth sailing all the time. And they're getting a realistic vision of what they could possibly expect in their own lives. And hopefully that to me is important because I don't know what my daughters are going to be. Some of them may choose to be the stay-at-home mom. That's fine. But I want whatever they do, I want it to be a conscious decision. And I want them to know that with the correct partner, they can do whatever they want to do.
I think one of the underlying themes in all the lead dad content is busyness. People are busy. Children have detailed schedule. Do you think this is true? Do you think that children are overscheduled?
As somebody whose children are overscheduled, I don't think they're overscheduled at all. What are you talking about, Joe? Look, you know, we grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts. This is not the same.
We had no schedule.
We literally had no schedule. And I rode a bike without a helmet on and I rode it at night. And somehow I've made it into my late 40s. Kids are very scheduled and it comes from a positive place. And I'm not quite sure if it's entirely good. And that positive place is I want my child to have the best opportunities in life, or I want my child to have the ability to do things that he or she wants. And I find that most parents are not operating in a zero-sum game. I want my child to have this so your child doesn't have it. They just want to have that opportunity. The idea of the three-sport athlete, that's a unicorn these days. Like when we were kids, you played whatever sport you played in the fall. You play whatever sport you play in the winter. You play whatever sport you play in the spring. And maybe you were better at one than the other, but you didn't play it all year round. And we have 6-7-year-old kids driving 2 hours to play ice hockey year round. So that part is different. I'm fortunate that my children don't have anything that they want to do that badly, that they're on travel teams, or that they don't have the sport aptitude to do it. But I'm sure I'd be just as guilty as everybody else if they did. And I'd be driving them around because I'd say, I want to do this and let me try to support them as much as I can.
One of the fascinating things about your last column is we got a fellow who is at a very high perch in the media industry who steps off to take a dive into the digital media world. What was the attraction of the digital media business? And do you think that this is a real phenomenon?
I won't call it the phenomenon. I'll speak for myself. For me, it was I'd done pretty much everything I wanted to do as a journalist, and I was still enjoying it. But I was so passionate about this idea to start the company of dads. And it became a digital media business because of a conversation that I had with a senior female executive. Her name is Leela Brennan. She worked at GoDaddy and now works for the founder of GoDaddy, Bob Parsons, who's a billionaire. He owns a bunch of businesses. She works at some of his golf brands, PXG, which is a great golf club maker. And I talked to her and I said, here's the idea. And she said, oh, my husband, Kevin, he's a lead dad. And I said, okay, good. He said, but I love this idea, but I got to be honest with you, writing a book, which is the original idea, writing a book is a horrible idea. I can't think of you spending 2 worst years of your life. And I was crestfallen because I thought that's originally what the Company of Dads was going to be. It was going to be a book exploring all these issues. And she said, this is too urgent. Something has changed from COVID. And this is not, what are you going to do? Lock yourself in your room for 2 years and write a book? And I was like, yeah, you put it that way. That doesn't sound so appealing, but yeah, that was the idea. And she said, no, this is a digital media company and a community. And it was that conversation with her, when I recently got to spend some time with her husband a year after the fact, that really got me to think differently because it sort of met the urgency of it. And so 2 of the 3 businesses of the Company of Dads are just that, is digital media company and a community platform. And then the third is working with companies on their employee resource groups and their engagements and the way to normalize working parents. But that first part, credit her with literally changing my thinking kind of thing. This is more immediate and you need to do something differently now.
Why do something like this rather than getting a lead dad's column for the Times?
Because I didn't want it to be about me. And my goal was to make it bigger than me. I'm one guy who's had one set of experiences in one part of the country. And in my most grandiose moments, I think of this as one day being the CNN for fathers. And people who are in their 20s right now, if they're listening to this in their 30s, I'm pretty sure they don't know who Ted Turner is. They don't remember that Ted Turner is a guy who started CNN. They think of what CNN has evolved into. And so my ultimate goal is for people not to even associate the Company of Dads with Paul Sullivan. My ultimate goal is for this to be the go-to global resource for men who have questions around fathers. And we just happen to be starting with Lead Dad.
Why do you feel like this is the way to reach people?
Because it's immediate and it gets to their attention. And to start any sort of print publication, it's a big ask. Whereas I knew from writing a weekly column that not everyone is going to resonate with people. And certain columns are going to resonate differently with different people. And I've taken the same approach that we're on, I think, podcast number 45 or 46. And it's finally getting to the point where people who I have no idea who they are reaching out and saying, hey, I listened to episode 22 or I listened to episode 37. And having that diversity of voices in there, one, it shows the depth and breadth of the Lead Dad community, but two, it allows people to enter in different ways. And we look like everybody else. We do a lot of social media. Some people may be coming to this from LinkedIn, which is a business audience. Some people may be coming to the Company of Dads through Instagram, which is a broader audience. But we've taken the approach to try to meet people where they are and give them shots on goal, give them different ways to come to the product that had this been a column in the New York Times is not going to go the same way. It would have been wonderful. It would have been incredible, but it would have reached that audience.
Paul Sullivan is the author of The Thin Green Line and the head of the Company of Dads. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paul.
Joe, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on as your guest.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate it.